Okay, David, thanks for the introduction. I would like to thank SPD, of course, for awarding me this prize. This is really a great honor for me. Can you hear me? Okay, so I would like to tell you a little bit about how solar eruptions and how are we modeling them. And, well, this talk will not be so very specific and detailed. It's more a bit of, let's say, entertainment, so you will see a lot of movies. And before I start, I would like, David said already a few things about me. I would like to show you a little bit, and in particular to thank a few people who helped me a lot and educated me. So as David said, I started in 2000 with my PhD in solar physics, and I was advised by this nice gentleman, most of you probably know. And after 3 years, something happened which most of you know as well. We ran out of money before I finished my thesis, so I had to emigrate, and the nice country which took me in was Scotland. So I went to for 15 months to St. Andrews University, where I was nurtured by Thomas Neukirch. And there, during this time, I indeed managed to finish my thesis. And as David mentioned, I was 3 years postdoc at MSSL, close to London, part of University College London, where I worked mainly with Lydia. And 3 more years I spent in Paris, where I worked mostly with Guillaume Ollagnier. So after 10 years, I was ready for the big jump. So I came to the US, and that's where I'm now, this in beautiful San Diego. This is the building where our office is of predictive science. And here are my nice colleagues, and some of them are here today. Okay, so let's start with a little outline. I would like to show you a little bit about solar eruptions and telling you what they are. And I will show a lot of movies, so most of you have probably seen them already, but I think there are younger people who might have not seen them, so I think they're very nice. And then I will talk a little bit about how we do modeling of eruptions in general, observational constraints, and so on. And this is, of course, a very big topic, so you could talk forever. And I picked two, I think, still open questions where I worked on. And this is how eruptions are initiated and driven out away from the sun. And another question which has attracted again some attention recently is the question whether these eruptions, or at least some of them, may be coupled. Now, as you will see, this the model I was using for addressing these questions is it's 3D, but it's still relatively idealized and simple. And there is another, let's say, road people are going on in modeling, which I would call global and thermodynamic simulations. So I would like to show you a little bit about this as well, and then finally a little outlook of what the next steps could be. Okay, so let's start. What are solar eruptions? Well, first of all, to mention they are the largest energy release event in the solar system. And the largest eruptions can release energies up to several 10 to 25 joule or 10 to 32 X. And just to give you an impression, if you compare this with the energy we are using on the whole world per year, that's something like 5 to 10 to 20 joule currently. So with one of these big events, basically we could feed the whole world with energy for, I don't know, several 10,000 years. However, fortunately, it's not available. All right, so now the next thing, of course, you all know that these eruptions occur in the atmosphere and the corona. And from observational point of view, there are three main times. Those are flares, prominence eruptions, and so-called coronal mass ejections, so CMEs. So I would like to walk you through these three types a little bit quickly. So flares, what are flares? I put here a the word eruptive flares, that's the kind of flares I talk about. There are, of course, a lot of flares on smaller scales, which are not, which may be by different mechanisms than eruptive mechanisms. So essentially, a flare is a sudden and localized increase of emission, which you can observe in most wavelengths, if not all. But most pronounced is in EUV and X-ray, and it can outshine the background emission of the sun by a factor of 1,000 or so. So here you see an example. And here are some light curves. So it's a very impulsive phenomenon. The first observation of a flare, at least to my knowledge, was done by Richard Carrington in 1859. This is a drawing he did when he observed this drawing of the sunspots. And you see these little white things which are marked by the letters. These were the signatures of the flare. This was a very strong flare, so this is why you could see it in white light. And two particular features of flares, beautiful features, is what we often see are these elongated rhythms and the arcades which form during these events. So for your entertainment, I picked three of the, I think, most beautiful cases. So here is the famous Bastille Day event. You see something gets off here, and then you see this long elongated arcade forming. Here's another case where you can see it from the side, and there is, again, something going off, and it has a lot of features like this downflows here, which people have worked on. And finally, here's one event from Hinode on 2006, where you nicely see these ribbons. So that are flares, big eruptive flares. And the next type of eruption are prominence eruptions. So here's prominence or filaments, as they're called, if you observe them on the disk. Here are two examples, a movie by Hinode. And this is a picture of a filament on the disk. So we all know these are dense and cool structures and suspended in the hot corona. They can be very large, several hundred thousand kilometers. And they exist for weeks, even months sometime. But eventually, most, if not all, of them finally erupt. So this is a very old observation from 1974 from HEO. Famous event called Granddaddy, so it's very impressive. Okay, finally, last but not least, we have coronal mass ejections. So what's that? These are huge expulsions of plasma and, as we know now, of magnetic field from the corona. They have masses of 10 billion tons, up to 10 billion tons, and can be very fast, 3,000 kilometers per second and more. And when the sun is active, you can have several a day. And during minima, it's a bit less, but they are still there. Now, what I was fascinated when I started to hear about CMEs is that they were actually discovered pretty late, in contrast to flares and prominence eruptions. So to my knowledge, this is the first white light observation of a CME done in 1971. Although people have seen this kind of things even during eclipses. Here's a drawing from 1860. So you see this feature here. Of course, at this time, it was not clear what it is. Okay, so yes, and here's a movie again for your entertainment. This spans over a week or 10 days or something like that, observed by the LASCO coronagraphs. And here is EIT, a picture of the sun overlaid. And so you can see how huge these events get and how powerful they are. All right, so why do we care? Well, of course, we are scientists, so we are curious and want to understand how these things work. But there is also a practical component, which is generally called space weather. Because these events can reach Earth and can interact with the magnetosphere, the particles can harm satellites, astronauts, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to go into this. You all know about that. And here's just an animation how a CME interacts with the magnetosphere. So of course, one of our goals in modeling eruption is that we want to get to a point one day that we can forecast the occurrence of these events and separately of that also their impact. Okay, so now when we start modeling, before we can do modeling, of course we have to look close what the observations are telling us in terms of constraints. Now, the first constraint is where do these things originate? And so we know that the large events, the strongest events, they all come from strong and powerful regions, active regions. Here's our favorite STO region. We have seen this many times, mostly above sunspot groups. You have also, of course, CMEs and quiescent prominence eruptions from all dispersed regions, weak fields. And there has been some discussion if there are different mechanisms at work. I think in principle not. And one common thing is that all these eruptions occur about the magnetic polarity inversion lines above and contain sheared fields. So that's one thing. The next thing to notice is that here is probably most of you know this event. It was 2011, June 7, and it had this huge filament eruption. And this is a nice example which shows you that at least in the large events, these three types, filament eruption, flare, CME, they really occur together. And given the fact that they are originating from magnetic fields, this already tells us that it's likely some violent disruption of the coronal magnetic field, what we are dealing with. Now, further constraints we have to take into account. If you make, this is from a paper of Terry Forbes, if you make a rough estimate about the energy you need for a CME, for a moderate CME, it's something like 100 X per cubic centimeter. And then if you make a rough estimate of the energies which are available in the corona, you see that it's the magnetic energy clearly dominates all others, and it's the only one which can provide these numbers you need. So from that, we really conclude that eruptions are magnetically driven, and other models are ruled out. Now, a second thing we have to take into account when we do the modeling is that the surface evolution, which you see here, this is a hint on the movie, taking place during the flare I showed you some slides ago, December 2006. So if you see this brightening here, this transient brightening, bang, there it was. That was the strong flare. But you hardly see any reaction of the field at the surface, so it doesn't seem to care. So this tells us for my modeling purpose that effectively the magnetic field is essentially anchored in the surface and does not move at all. So that's what we refer to sometimes as line tight field. Okay, and then the next thing is we know from both observations and, for example, from nonlinear force free extrapolation, which you see an example here, that the energy we need in order to get an eruption is stored in electric currents, distributed currents in the corona, which means we have sheared or twisted magnetic fields, which we refer to as the core fields. So that's what you see here in red. This is isosurfaces of currents. And this field is held down by the essentially potential field above it and stabilized. We saw these things during several talks in the past days. And so how does this form? Of course, this field forms by both emergence and by flows. This shears up and the energy is slowly accumulated and the overlying field holds it in equilibrium. Okay, so all this put together brings us to a, let's say, basic eruption scenario. So initially, we have the pre-eruption phase. So this energy is accumulated, these sheared fields are stored, they're held down. So we have essentially a closed configuration in the corona. Then, apparently, by the stresses which are exerted by the flow and emergence, they exceed some kind of threshold, the field starts to open up and evolves into the CME. That's the initiation. And finally, we have what we sometimes refer to as the main phase. During the main phase, we get this huge expansion of the field, in other words, the CME. We form a vertical current sheet below it, and reconnection is the process which reconfigures the field to a lower energy state, and this is what observationally then we see as a flare. So here is a nice example of a SOHO observation which basically shows this kind of picture here. So you see the newly formed reconfigured loops below. Okay, now before I really start with the models, I would like to say some general things about how we do this modeling. This is based on this very nice little review by Terry Forbes, 2001. So virtually all models are which we are using now are formulated as initial boundary value problems, which means we have a set of differential equations, which is typically we use single fluid MHD. We have a set of boundary conditions, the photosphere, of course, mostly, which is quite well constrained by observations. And we have an initial state of our simulation, which is less well constrained because we don't know the magnetic field in the corona. And so we have to keep in mind when we do this that there are, of course, certain limitations. We use the MHD approximation, which means we cannot model things like particle acceleration, kinetic effects. We don't know the detailed structure of the magnetic field, so our initial states are more or less ad hoc. And finally, as always, computer power is limited, which means we are forced to remove the complexity of this configuration. So all these models simplify to some degree. And we are not able yet to resolve the huge range of length scales, things which are going on during the reconnection up to the millions of miles of CME expansion. But nevertheless, these models are very valuable because we can use them to test physical mechanisms. And as I will show you later, we slowly start to overcome these kind of limitations. Okay, so that brings me now to the first point I want to talk about a little bit is how are eruptions triggered and driven. Now the first thing you note, if you look into the literature, there's a bunch of models. This is a nice slide Bernhard Klim put together. So I cannot talk about all of them, of course, so I will talk about the one I was working on, which is here, which is the so-called flux rope instabilities models. So how is this motivated? Now, this is motivated by some basic simple observations which I try to illustrate here. So first of all, you see very often a single loop-shaped structure during eruptions, like here. You can see signatures of internal twist, like in the CME, and in some cases, you see a clear helical deformation, kind of a rotation of the structure. And this suggests two things. This suggests that you have the magnetic geometry of a flux rope, at least in this phase you see here. And this deformation indicates a certain MHD instability, which is the kink instability, and which occurs if you have a twisted flux rope and the twist by some reason exceeds a certain threshold. That leads to this kind of deformation, which you see here. So this was the first project I was doing. And so what did we do? We used an analytical coronal flux rope model, the model by Titov and Desmoulins. I don't want to go into the details here, but it's basically of a force-free flux rope anchored at the photosphere. And so what we did is we used this as initial condition. We varied the twist. It's relatively easy to choose the twist in this model. And we made a quite long parametric study. I don't want to bore you with this. Just want to show one case where we tweaked the twist. So we adjusted the twist in the model. And here you see this kink instability. These are magnetic field lines. And we find a very nice agreement with confined filament eruption. Now, just to mention this, this simulation doesn't, we don't care about how this flux swap comes in there. So this is really just a part of the story. Even more, it is not in equilibrium. So we start already with an unstable configuration. You could do this, of course, starting from equilibrium. It would be more difficult. And let me mention that at the same time when we were doing this, also Yuhong Fan and Sarah Gibson came up with a very, very similar model. And one point I like to emphasize here is you don't get an eruption. So the rope is rising due to the instability, but then it stops. The field which is above it is simply too strong. It cannot escape. Actually, it is not shown in this movie here, but the top of the rope gets fully destroyed by reconnection in this simulation. So we don't get a CME. It's a nice result, but it's not the full story. And by the way, the same is true for this event, by the way. It didn't make it. There was no CME. So it rose to something like 80 megameter, and then it stopped. And well, this tells us that the kink instability may work in some of these events, but it's definitely not a mechanism which can explain you all eruptions for several reasons. I mean, one reason is, first of all, it's not in the nature of this instability to cause the huge expansion you see in CMEs. And second, there are many, if not most, events where you don't see such a clear rotation and deformation. So there must be something else. And the next thing we were looking at is, we heard this mentioning today several times, what we call torus instability. This is basically known from plasma physics, this instability. And so what is this about? So imagine that you have a current ring, or let's say a toroidal flux rope if you want. Now, such a system as alone is not stable. There is a so-called hoop force which wants to expand this current ring. And one way to picture this is, if you look here, this is a cross-section. So we cut through this ring at one part of it, and we look at it from the side. And here's the current, and that's the field that it produces. It's like in a wire, but now because it's curved, the field is more packed inside the ring than outside. And of course, since field lines want to be as far away from each other as they can, so the magnetic pressure is stronger here, and this thing simply wants to expand. So if you want to stabilize this, because on the sun we have stable structures before they erupt, as I said, filaments can be seen for weeks or months, you have to add an external field. So if you do this, if you add a field which strengthens the field here and weakens it here, if you do this cleverly, you can achieve an equilibrium. So the interaction of this new field which you have introduced, if you do this right, you get a second force which points inwards and which balances the so-called hoop force. So now, what is this torus instability about? Imagine that by some mechanism you expand this ring. So it starts to expand. Now, as you do this the hoop force, so which here you see that's the major radius of the ring, so the hoop force will decrease. On the other hand, the external field, here it's a uniform field, but on the sun, of course, you have the external field, but the field which holds the whole thing down will also decrease with distance, okay? So, and the point of this torus instability is basically, as if you perturb the system and the ring, the flux slope starts to expand, which of these two forces decays faster? That's the question. Now, if the hoop force drops faster with distance, it will not be balanced anymore, and you get this quite violent expansion. On the other hand, if the external field drops slowly, then you get the opposite effect. You perturb it, and it will you will find a new equilibrium. Okay, and so what we did with so as I said, this idea is of course not new. This goes back. You can find this in Bateman's book, and this has been done for straight current channels. In this paper, for example, Fontaine and Kuperus. So what we did with Bernhard is basically to calculate these things a bit closer. And so if you make such a simple ansatz for this external field which holds the current down, you can find that there is, Antonia was mentioned this today, that there is a critical decay index, we call this, critical drop of this external field. And if you manage to get into this area during the expansion of your ring, this instability will set in. So that's the basic idea. So on this, yes, these calculations were all done, of course, for a freely expanding current ring. On the sun, we have a different situation. We have partial rings, and they are line tight. They are anchored in the photosphere. So this to do this analytically is very, very difficult. So we used numerical simulations to see if these things still work if you have a line tight flux rope, and we found actually very similar thresholds. So on the sun, what does this mean for the sun? This means in eruptions, very often you see a slow rise phase initially. And this may be to reconnection below or other things. And so this instability can occur if this mechanism, whatever it is, lifts this filament or flux rope up to a height where you get this, where you meet this threshold. So for example, here you see that in many cases it starts slowly and then suddenly it goes quickly. And the good thing on this instability compared to the kink instability, it can really explain this the huge expansion you see. Okay, but that's, of course, this is just part of the story. What about reconnection? Reconnection is equally, if not even more important, in eruption as well. So there are basically two important types of reconnection during eruption. One is within or below what we call the core field. Here is a very nice sketch from Ron Moore's paper, which illustrates this. So here you have a filament, you have shear arcade, very similar to what Antonia was showing. And then by some process, let's say converging flows, flux cancellation, you bring these arcades together and they start to reconnect slowly. It's a slowly driven process. You successively form a flux rope, and this rope then erupts. And so the important point of this reconnection, one is that it can transfer sheared fields, arcade fields, and if you look at filament observation, we often see very sheared fields. And during this phase, this slow rise phase, you may transform a lot of this into a more rope-like structure. And as the eruption then proceeds, of course, the field expands, you get this current sheet, and the reconnection below speeds up. It's a runaway process. So it's what we call then flare reconnections, exactly what Antonia was talking about. And this process, the reconnection you get below during the flare, is also very important to drive the eruption, because it does two things. It helps you. You see these feed lines, if they reconnect, this is still field which tries to hold down the flux rope. So if you reconnect them, they are not line-tight anymore, or they will be line-tight somewhere else. So what you do is that you decrease the tension of this overlying field. And at the same time, you add more twisted field to the flux rope. Okay? So this is a process which also helps a lot to drive the eruption. Second is what if you have reconnection above, what we refer to as breakout reconnection. And this, particularly in the strong events where you have very complex field, you can be sure that you will get null points or separator lines above. And here's a simulation Ben Lynch did in 2008. And so this kind of reconnection can do two things. First of all, as you will see later, it can trigger, start the eruption by again weakening this overlying field by removing it. And the other thing is that it can speed up. If the reconnection in front of the rope removes field, it can speed up the eruption significantly. Okay, then one point I would like to emphasize it, that these processes, maybe except for extreme cases, they all work together. You cannot take one of these processes and get an eruption by itself, okay? You will always have a reconnection below if your flux rope erupts, and you will always get the hoop force working once you form these ropes. And in complex fields, you will always have some reconnection above it. So we should not look at them as concurrent or separate processes. This will not work out. And which one is dominant? That's a good question. And this is something we have not yet looked systematically. And this will most probably depend on the circumstances, on the magnetic configuration. I mean, the simulations I did over the years, I have seen cases which appear to be mostly driven by instability and reconnection sets in very late. I have seen other ones where I had the impression that it's really the reconnection which speeds it up. But as I said, we have to look at this closer. So I think we need some parametric studies to try to disentangle these effects a bit better as we have done so far. So there is work to do. Okay, the next thing I want to switch now is the question of coupling between eruptions. So these are what we refer to often as sympathetic events. Now this is based on the fact that often, here is an example, you see one eruption, then there was something here, here's the second one, here is another one. So very often we see eruptions almost the same time or the shortly after each other from different source regions. And here is another example, two CMEs coming out, each of them from these two regions and within something like 20 minutes. Now, of course, just from looking at this, this is very hard to say. Are they connected or is it just a coincidence that they go off at the same time? And so people have done statistical studies based on the waiting times between eruptions and so on, which indicates that at least some of them are somehow linked causally. And over the years, there were several mechanisms have been suggested, waves, reconnection, interaction by surges, subsurface, even subsurface connections, but there were no clear models so far. So that's what work we did. We looked at these events, which took place 2010 in August 1 and 2. This is a movie actually from recent paper by Karel Shriver and the Lockheed Group. You can download all these movies. It's on, if you look in the paper, there is a link. They are huge though, I warn you. It's 2 gigabytes or something. And these are running ratio movies. It's actually a method Cooper Downs developed, where you use three channels and you color them differently, and this is a running ratio, as I said, and the point is that the red tells you where stuff gets hotter and blue where stuff cools down. But I'm using this now just to give you an illustration of that there were several events taking place here. So you see it starts out. Here is one eruption, here is another one, here is one, and so on. So let's not go in all the details here. There is also a paper by Karel and Allen where they analyzed the field using potential field extrapolations and their conclusion was that all of the source regions involved in this sympathetic event were connected magnetically. So what we did, of course, we tried to simplify this first. So we picked three of these events, which you see here. That's a stereo movie. That was the first one, second one, and here the third one. Here are some stills. You see eruption one, eruption two, and finally eruption three. So it appears that this first eruption triggered the other ones. I mean, this is what we were looking into. And the interesting fact to note is that the filament, which is further away from the perturbing eruption, goes off first. Naively, you would expect that the one which is right next to him will be disturbed and go off, but this was not the case here, so I come back to that. Okay, so here's some further information. Here's an H-alpha image. So here you see filaments 2 and 3, they were pretty large, and filament 1, pretty small here. And here's the magnetogram with the contours overlaid. So again, filament 1, 2, and 3. You see they are red is positive polarity, blue is negative polarity, line of sight. And so if you do an extrapolation, you see that these two guys, 2 and 3, were located in the lobes of a so-called pseudostreamer, which is a typical configuration for this magnetic fields. And so here it is again. So what we did is we set up, we used again the Titov-Desmoulins model. We set up this configuration. So here we take two flux rope embedded in this pseudostreamer structure you see here. And we put another rope to its side, which is supposed to model filament one. And then just for simplicity, because it's much easier to create a numerical equilibrium, we put a rope also on this side. Okay? And so, as you see already, this looks very symmetric. So it ignores the different sizes of the filament, that they are not exactly parallel, etc. So it's really a proof of concept thing. And we used here ideal MHD equations and the simplest case in zero beta. So all the reconnection which will happen here is due to numerical diffusion. So now, what do we do? So here again is the setup, slightly different colors. And what we do is that we start, we use converging flows, which lifts up this flux rope here, and we trigger the eruption of this filament one. And then we let the system go and see what happens. So let's have a look at this. Initial relaxation phase, now we push here, so this goes up, and you see that the other two are following. Let's play it one more time. And the dark stuff shows your current sheet. So you see a current sheet is here, and you get reconnection above. And then also below, that's a bit quick, so let's look at the skills, stills. So here is the first eruption triggered by whatever means, which goes off. As it pushes against this pseudostreamer, it's a separator line, so basically an X line, if you want, at the top of this structure here. So these are the regions where, of course, current sheets form easily. So as you push here, you form this current layer or current sheet, if you want, and you see it has a tilted orientation. So what happens? This open field here, the pink field here, and the closed field, green field, they come together, they reconnect. So that's exactly a breakout reconnection. And so what you effectively do is you remove the flux here, you weaken the flux, it's actually transported to this other lobe here, and so you reduce the magnetic tension, so the flux rope starts to rise slowly. And at a certain point it becomes unstable and speeds up very much, and you see it starts to push out the current sheet out of the way. So that's the first thing that happens. Now, as the rope goes up, you again get the vertical current sheet below, like in every eruption. This is, I hope you can see, this is what you see here. And now what happens is that this previously closed field, which was closed down here by the first reconnection, as well as this green field, which has opened up, they come now together. And they form the classical flare loops, if you want. And again, this field is now removed and is shuffled back. And since this reconnection in stronger fields is stronger and more effective, it does not just remove the field you just added, it even removes the original green field lines. So as a result, also this other guy will start to erupt. And here is a nice example of what I mentioned. These three mechanisms work together here. You get three connection above, which triggers the eruption in the first place. If you don't have this, nothing would happen. And then you get the instability, torus instability of the flux op speeds up, pushes everything away. And finally, you get the reconnection, the flare reconnection below, which further drives the eruption and triggers the subsequent one. Okay, so now this is just a slide discussing briefly the validity of this idealized model. Here's again, I just put together here some stills of the various flux ropes and the observed prominences. So what can we learn from this model? First, of course, it suggests how one eruption can trigger subsequent eruptions. And the interesting thing, it indeed reproduces the order of the eruptions. So as you can see, the one which is further away of the to the initial eruption goes first, and the one that is closer goes next. This has to do with the how the reconnection proceeds in the first place, on the orientation of the current layer. So, however, this of course is still difficult to confirm, because this first reconnection, so the reconnection above is probably relatively high up, and it does not give you clear observational signatures. So we were looking at that, but we couldn't find clear signatures of that. So you need support. And one support comes, and this is what my colleague Slava Titov is doing, from topological analysis. So you have to go to the real data, to the real event, you take the magnetogram, you extrapolate, you calculate the coronal field, and then using several tools, Antonia mentioned, for example, squashing factor and so on, you can figure out the exact topology of this configuration, pseudo-streamers, separator lines, etc., etc. And this also helps you to support or to reject this scenario here. And what we found is that it's in very good agreement. So it appears that for this subset of eruptions, it appears really believable that this mechanism was at work. And of course, you can go further. So the next steps will be, Slava is now analyzing this with an MHD solution. And at some point, you want to do even modeling for these realistic fields. And we started this. I'll show you a little bit about this in a moment. Okay. I don't know. How much time do I have? I'm okay? Couple of minutes. All right. Okay. So the simulations I showed you so far are relatively simple and idealized. Now, the good thing on this kind of models is that they are cheap computationally. So you can run them on workstations even, at least in zero beta approximation. So that helps you to really study and test simple basic mechanisms. That allows you to make parametric studies. So that's one way to go, and we should definitely keep this. But there is another road people are going, and let's say these are the state-of-the-art models, and they aim for much more realism. And there are several ingredients which make the step from the simple model, which we have seen, to these models. First, they really use large spherical domains. So the simulations I showed you were in relatively small Cartesian domains. And so you want to model the extended corona, you want to include the solar wind. Then the other important thing I'll show you in a minute, you want to use real data. You want to use observed magnetic fields as boundary condition. And the third thing this model aim at is to model the energy transport in the corona much more realistically, which means including a coronal heating mechanism, including thermal conduction and radiative losses. And you need this. If you really want to do the emission right of the sun, in particular, distinguishing active regions, quiet sun, coronal hosts, etc., you are forced to go this way. And here is an example. That's a simulation by Jung Mok and others of an active region. So this shows you what you can do once you put in all this realistic plasma treatment and energy treatment. So you can reproduce basically, you can synthesize from the model observations as the satellites would see them, and that allows you a direct comparison. So now if you want to do CMEs and the corona, how is this done? So first, typically you would start, because of course you need the whole sun, you want to model, so you use synoptic magnetograms, which you may have to filter and smooth a bit and so on. And you may use higher resolution in your source region you want to model, etc. But that's the principle. You use these synoptic magnetograms. And as boundary condition, you put in your solar wind initial condition, and then you calculate the MHD solution using all these energy transport processes. And of course, you start with extrapolated potential field. And then after some time, you will get to this relaxed state where the field has opened up due to the solar wind, and you reproduce streamers, pseudo-streamers, and so on. And now this, of course, this, you use the density and temperature, and you can produce these synthetic emission images. This is here an example for AIA. And you can compare with the observation to test how good your model is. And in the meantime, I think the match is pretty good, what can be done by now. Okay, now CMEs. So now what you want to have a CME within this global configuration. There are different ways to do this. I don't want to go into all the details, but what is often used is that you take, for example, the Titov-Desmoulins flux rope model and you insert it into your existing configurations. Now you can do this by either taking an unstable rope, which immediately erupts. You can do this more sophisticated. You can try to reach an equilibrium also by imposing a boundary evolution. And now you trigger this eruption by converging flows, for example, and then you can study your CME. So here's an example. This is an idealized configuration, by the way, so it's not based on data, but it includes the thermodynamics. And then you can study and compare and learn from these simulations. Okay, then you can go further out. Of course, you have these large spherical domains. You can produce polarization, brightness images, synthetic ones, and to see how your CME looks further out. You can study waves, etc. And one interesting thing, for example, if you do this, is now the great advantage, you can now look in your simulation from every viewing angle you want, which, of course, in observation is not possible. And here is one example, so you can find quite big differences if you do this. This is the very same eruption from two different viewpoints, and you see it makes a huge difference. So here's a running ratio, and here is the polarization brightness. And these things are important if we want to estimate CME mass and this kind of thing, so we have to work on that. Okay, finally, next step, we want to go even further out now towards Earth. And Well, one thing about the thermodynamic simulations is due to thermal conduction, the resolution you need, as Steve was talking about, is a little bit. So they are pretty expensive. So you don't want to do this out to 1 AU. And one way to go is that you take your coronal solution simulation, which includes the thermodynamic that's here, to, let's say, 20 solar radii. That's the white circle here. And you couple it with a heliospheric code, which has a reduced set of equations, and which is therefore much less expensive. So you have to couple, I don't go into details here now, but basically you couple these two codes at the boundary. And what you see here is an example of such a simulation. It starts out at the sun, and what you see here is basically density. And then we couple the two, so we use the boundary condition of the coronal well to couple it to the interplanetary simulation, and you see it works quite well. And then, of course, what you can do, again, you can do synthetic in situ measurements from the data and compare to magnetic clouds, etc. All right, okay, really final. And so the where does this go? So yes, one thing we are working on where we want to go is to model indeed observed events in such an environment. So here are MHD solutions for this case I showed before where the sympathetic eruptions took place in XRT, and this is AIA 211 wavelength. Again, you can compare this to the observation and check how good they are. And what we want to do now is to model this using real magnetic field boundary data to model these eruptions. Right now, this is done in zero beta to test out the parameters. And in the future, this should be done in this full thermodynamic model. And another case we are working on is right now is the Bastille Day event. So, okay, let me summarize. The idealized simulations have helped us a lot to understand the mechanisms which are at work, initiation mechanisms, and so on, in solar eruptions or also for the sympathetic eruptions. And although these large simulations are, of course, way more appealing, we have to continue. There is still a lot to be done with the relatively simple models. The global simulations I showed, which use real data and improve the description of plasma and energy flow, they are emerging now, so there was a lot of progress in recent years. They will give us a deeper insight in various mechanisms and will allow us, well, realistic, I wouldn't call it yet, but at least a semi-realistic modeling of observed eruptions. Finally, what I showed also is we are able now to couple these simulations with heliospheric models, so soon we will be able to simulate observed events from Sun to Earth. And, okay, so still it will... although they are semi-realistic, there are still a lot of idealizations. And I think it will take many years till we are at the point that we have models which can really resolve the scales are present in all these eruptions. We solve the complete set of plasma equations, and we use boundary and initial conditions that really match at least the observed reality. One can discuss, of course, if we really need this. But right now, this will be still be a long way to go. And final, it's just a few little outlook of things which may be the next steps which people are working on already or might be working on. So one thing which is a helpful thing here is a simulation by Judy Carpen recently is adaptive mesh refinement, which means that you increase dynamically the resolution of your grid wherever you need it. So that will help us, of course, to get a better modeling of reconnection shocks and so on. Other thing people have started to do is to couple MHD with PIC, with kinetic codes. Here is an example, Gisela Baumann and Arke Nordlund. This particular thing is a jet simulation coming from flux emergence. So they use this to couple that with their kinetic code to look how particles behave. Another thing which can be done is to couple also the more and more realistic simulations of flux emergence, which produce, in principle, pre-eruption configurations in the corona with the existing CME models. So some work in this direction has been done by Ilya and his co-workers recently. And another example is that we would like at some point to develop evolutionary models. Right now, these thermodynamic MHD models I showed you are, of course, just one snapshot in time. So you would like to evolve this. And finally, use this as a framework to simulate CMEs, and hopefully we can do this in not too far future. And of course, one thing we would like to achieve is that we can then simulate the CMEs in real time. So we see them coming off, we start them in the model, and they will arrive before the real one do. So that's where we want to go. Okay, thank you so far. I try.
We heard an observational talk on CMEs by Gopal Swami. Yes. One of the things that he showed was simple self-similar expansion of a CME produced very good agreement of the fields seen near Earth in magnetic clouds. In view of what for example, the Leonel et al. Calculation and others that preceded. Does that surprise you?
We are right now in the process of looking at this. We are trying to analyze the topological structure of the eruption further out. I mean, it's a bit difficult because if you just draw field lines, for example, it's a mess. There is a lot of reconnection with the ambient field. There is reconnection within the structure. So how well this resembles this the self-similar expansion, or how well it resembles this Pete Riley models of the pancake, I cannot tell you yet. We are looking into this right now.
On behalf of the Harvey family, let me congratulate you on getting the award and thank you for your excellent lecture.
This is something that we briefly discussed, but my question is related to the force balance of the flux rope, especially in the pre-eruption phase. And the two forces you discussed are the hoof force due to the current and the restoring force provided by the strapping field. Yes. But in principle, one can have a very stable flux rope without a strapping field if the current is low and if the magnetic tension force provided by the axial field is sufficient. So can you comment on the importance of magnetic tension force in this situation? Is it negligible or we should consider it?
Well, in order to answer that, you would have to really study this using the model. But we are guided by the what we see on the sun. And what we see is that we have sheared or twisted fields following the neutral line, and we have field which runs essentially perpendicular above it, what I called overlying field, which holds it down. So these models are designed basically to do that. That's what the sun is telling us.